people then shouted, "Hip, hip," at the top of his voice, three times, and the assembly roared, "Hooray, hooray, hooray." Thereafter, he again wished everyone happy holidays. Then the following perennial closing hymn was sung. God be with you till we meet again. By his counsel's guide uphold you. His sleep securely fold you. God be with you till we meet again. The assembly was ordered dismissed. Some of the students who had been around the school longer and had caught the full spirit of the end-of-the-year festivities hugged and kissed and shook hands with each other. Some even cried. I felt a slight sadness at the thought of not seeing my friends for 2 months, the length of the Christmas holidays. That night, my mother, upon hearing the news that I had come out number one in my class, hugged and kissed me so many times and made me so many promises. Before the night was over, the yard was buzzing with news of a teacher-to-be at the Matabane's household. Granny was told the good news and she promised me many things. I felt happy and proud. I even began to like school. What was so remarkable about my first year performance was that I had come out number one despite chronically lacking books, having to resort to paying more attention during class lectures, borrowing other children's books to do homework, and relying on a picture book memory during exams. My accomplishment at school must have touched my father's heart. For one Friday night in my second year of school, he did something that made me cry. "Johannes, come here," he called. I went. He had just arrived from work and was sitting by the table, waiting for dinner, which my mother was busy serving. Flora was singing lullabies to Miriam. Maria was playing placidly with her frayed rag doll, and George huddled near the brazier, sleeping. "How much is a slate?" he asked.
20 cents.
"School fees?" 1 rand 20 for the entire year. "That much?" my father cried, astounded. The amount was a tenth of his wages. "Where in the hell do teachers think we black people can get that type of money? They must be mad. Black people aren't flushed with money like white people are." Turning to my mother, he said, "I told you, woman, not to take him to the damn school. Now, where do you think he will get money to buy slates and pay school fees? Not from me." Humbly, my mother said, "Well, I bought him that one slate. He broke it and kept using the pieces for a year. And I've already paid his school fees for this year." "Where did you get the money?" asked my father suspiciously. "I didn't use your money, if that's what you're thinking," my mother said. "Granny gave me from the little she had." "Now, who is going to pay for him next year? And the next? And the next?"
"Won't you have a change of heart, Jackson?" my mother asked. "He's your son, you know. The money you're wasting on liquor and gambling could pay for his school needs. He's already done well his first year, and who knows? If he keeps on doing well, someday he may get a good job and take care of you in your old age."
"I don't believe in schools, woman,"
my father said emphatically.
"How often do I have to tell you that? Just look at all those so-called educated people. What has education done for them? They pick garbage, wash cars, work as garden boys and delivery boys. Is that what people pay all this money to go learn at school? I myself wouldn't go even if school were free."
"There are teachers, doctors, and nurses," my mother said. "He can become a teacher."
"And how much will he be paid?"
my father returned sarcastically.
"There are teachers I know who are making half of what the garbage man makes."
All that this talk did was confuse me.
"How much did you say a slate was?"
my father turned to me and asked.
20 cents.
"And that other book, how much is it?"
"You mean a primer? 40 cents.
"Here's 60 cents, he said, reaching deep into his pocket.
My mouth dropped. I thought I was dreaming. My mother's face broke into a wide smile.
"Come on.
What are you frozen for?"
my father said to me.
"Do you want the money or don't you?"
I timidly reached out and took the money. Tears stood in my eyes. I wanted to kiss him, fall on my knees and worship him, do anything to show him how thankful I was.
"Say thanks to your father," my mother said.
"Thanks, Papa," I said in a trembling voice.
"But don't you get any ideas now," my father said. "This doesn't mean I'm going to buy you everything for school. When you've learned how to read and write letters, I want you to stop going. That's all the education you will need to get by in this world."
Flora was now 6 years old. At my mother's insistence, she too began school. The burden of financing both our educations rested entirely on my mother. Even though my father tried to help from time to time, she begged and borrowed to pay for Flora's school fees, which were demanded upon registration. I was now in Standard 1, having passed Substandard B at the top of my class. My school needs had increased. When I asked my mother how she thought she was ever going to keep us both in school, considering she was having enormous difficulties keeping me there, she calmly replied, "I'll tackle each problem as it comes, and God will help me." The problems kept on coming, but God's help didn't. School turned into a nightmare. I began coming home with bruises, unable to sit down or sleep for days because I had been whipped by teachers for failing to pay my school fees on time and for lacking in books and a proper uniform. I would occasionally attempt to lie my way out each time I was threatened with a beating, by telling teachers that I would be getting the required books and uniform and would be paying my school fees by the end of the month. However, months would go by with no job in sight for my mother, and I would continue without school paraphernalia. My father tried to buy my sister and me a few exercise books, worth about 10 cents or so each, and pay the 300 cents a year each for school fees. But he soon gave up the idea because he was paid so little. Our household needs were so many, and school was a low priority item in the house. survival was first.
How many months have to end before you pay your school fees and start wearing the proper uniform?
A teacher asked me one morning during uniform inspection.
And where are your primers?
I dropped my eyes to the floor and lied. My mother said I would be getting everything at the end of the month.
The end of which month?
The teacher said with a touch of sarcasm.
This one? The next one? Or the one 10 years down the road? You've been saying the end of the month since the beginning of the year, and school is nearly over. And other teachers who've had you in their classes over the years have told me that you've been giving them the end of the month line too.
My eyes still on the floor, I mumbled. The end of this month, sir.
Look at me when I speak to you.
The teacher screamed at me. I looked at him, or rather beyond him and at the blackboard mounted on the red bricked wall, as he stood akimbo next to the cupboard where he kept his array of canes. I was standing in an aisle between benches, on exhibit before the entire class. During uniform inspection, the entire class of boys and girls was required to stand at ease between the aisles, and each pupil would be told by the teacher to sit down, provided he or she was properly dressed, had the required books, and had passed the neatness test. Trimmed nails, combed hair, polished shoes, and so on.
Do you know you're the only one who doesn't have the proper uniform and primers? The teacher said. And do you know that it's the law to have those things? And do you know that you may fail as a result? Do you know?
I nodded feebly, my head cast down like a victim awaiting sentencing.
Why aren't you like any normal child, huh?
The teacher said, fixing a stern look at me. Shaking his head, he went on.
It's still a mystery to me how you managed to come out number one in class. What's the problem?
I kept my head down and didn't answer him. He knew what my problem was. I was growing angry over the public interrogation. Yet there was nothing I could do but endure the ordeal. After verbally humiliating me, the teacher called me up to the front of the class, grabbed a thick cane out of the cupboard, told me to straddle the table, and whipped me a dozen lashes. Tears welled in my eyes. I clenched my teeth and in my mind called him all sorts of obscene names as he lashed me mercilessly. Week after week, the pattern repeated itself. Some teachers, particularly the women, were sympathetic and did not whip me. Others, however, simply said, "You're not different from other school children. They too have parents who have trouble getting jobs. Yet they have uniforms and books." I began hating all teachers. I became disenchanted with school. I began asking myself, why was it a crime to be without books and a proper uniform? I desperately wanted to learn how to read and write. But if learning meant being whipped constantly for things I had no control over and probably never could have, I was prepared to seriously reconsider my desire to learn. One day, I decided to have it out with my mother.
"Mama, I don't want to go to school anymore," I said.
"What's the matter?" my mother asked.
"I can't take the punishment any longer."
"Can't you bear it just a little longer?"
"Until I get a job," she said. "Then I'll be able to buy you school things."
I told her that I would go back only when I had a uniform and books.
"But you lose much while you're away," she said, "and you may never be able to catch up. Who knows how long it will take for me to find a job?"
Then I'll leave school altogether. I declared. I was only 9 years old.
If you leave school, what will you do? What job will you get?
I was tongue-tied. Yes, if I left school at that age, what would I do? How would I earn a living? What kind of job could a 9-year-old who could barely write a complete sentence of English do? Though I had friends who had left school and their homes at 7 and 8 years old, and were now living in junkyards and dilapidated buildings, supporting themselves through stealing and handouts, I had no confidence in myself that I could do likewise. But what other choice did I have as a Kaffir boy?
What should I do then, Mama? I said in despair. I'm tired of being punished all the time for books and a uniform I may never have.
Stay in school, child, my mother said. Stay in school, she repeated in a tone full of hope. And as soon as I find a job, the first thing I'll do with my first wages will be to buy you and your sister books and uniforms. I may not be able to buy you everything all at once, but I'll do my best. And before you know it, both you and your sister will have everything and be just like other school children. Soon after that conversation, a miracle occurred. My mother at last found a housekeeping job at the Indian place on First Avenue. She was able to take it because she didn't need a permit to work in Alexandra. The back-breaking job required her to work 6 days a week, scrubbing floors, washing clothes, cleaning windows, cooking and tending babies, and washing diapers for an Indian trader named Shorty, who had a very large family. Those 6 months pregnant with her fifth child, my mother took the job. In fact, she was ecstatic over it. "For you, children," she said the day she found the job, "I'll sacrifice even my life." Tears came to my eyes when I heard that. She began talking about what she was going to do with her wages. 20 rands a month. Buy diapers, books, uniforms, and pay school fees, and pay for maternity care at the clinic so that nurses could attend to her when the time came. My arithmetic told me that 20 rands couldn't accomplish all that. And so, each morning, she would get up at 6 and walk all the way from 13th Avenue to 1st Avenue, a distance of about 2 miles to and fro. Sometimes she would get lifts from kind bus drivers. When she got home late in the evening, she brought with her curried leftovers, mangoes, and other Indian food. My father stopped giving my mother grocery money. "You're working now," he said one Friday night, "so you two can help pay for things around the house." My mother didn't argue. At no other time did I hate my father more than when he did this. I swore in my heart that someday I would make him pay dearly for it. As far as I was concerned, I had no father. He used the extra money to gamble and buy alcohol. "Mama, when will I get the books?" I asked her a month after she had been working. "You'll get them soon, child. I bought groceries with what I would have used for your books, because your father didn't give me grocery money this week. Have patience." One evening, my mother returned home from work carrying on her head a big box. "I have books for you, Johannes," she said with a smile, "and a new slate for you, Flora." I was overjoyed. The box contained curried leftovers, bruised mangoes, and a dozen or so books, which my mother said she had bought at a flea market near where she worked. As my brother and sisters clawed each other over the food, she and I went over the books.
"Can you use this one?"
she asked eagerly, showing me a book written, I didn't know till later, in Chinese. I took it and flipped through the pages, pondering the alien script. Unable to decipher the abstruse writing, I shook my head.
"No."
"What about this one?" she said, showing me a book written in French. I again shook my head.
"No."
"And this one?" A book written in Arabic.
"No."
"This one?" A book written in Hindu.
"No." "This one?"
A book written in German.
"No."
"And this one?" A book written in Afrikaans.
"No."
"Are you sure they don't use any of them at your school?" my mother asked.
"I'm sure, Mama," I said emphatically.
"Why? But they're books, aren't they?"
"Just because they're books, Mama," I said, "doesn't mean we use them at school. They're written in languages we don't use at school. Our school uses only the Tsonga language."
"What languages are they written in?"
"I don't know."
"How then can you tell?"
"I can't read them, Mama, that's how. If they were written in Tsonga, I could at least read them."
My mother doubted me, for she said, "Let's take the book to Mr. Brown." Mr. Brown was one of the few persons in the yard with the equivalent of a high school education. He was a bus driver for Patco, but he also operated a sort of moving service, transporting people and goods between Alexandra and the tribal reserve of the vendors. "Maybe you can tell us what languages they're written in, and whether you can use them in later classes."
"I don't think I'll ever be required to use them, Mama."
"How do you know?" We went to Mr. Brown's shack.
"You say you bought these books for your son, huh?"
Mr. Brown asked my mother as he skimmed through the books, his brow knitted, giving him a look of someone very learned.
"Yes," my mother said humbly.
"Where again did you say you bought them?"
Mr. Brown asked.
"And how much, may I ask?"
My mother told him.
"No wonder you got them so cheap," Mr. Brown said, laughing. "They are worthless to your son. Tribal schools don't use these books, for they are written in French, German, Arabic, Hindu, and Chinese. Languages which I, too, can't read."
"But the people at the flea market told me these were school books," my mother said.
"They're school books, all right," Mr. Brown sighed deeply. "But only white people and Indians use them." A look of dejection crossed my mother's face, and her bony shoulders drooped in resignation. As she began putting the books in the box, like someone collecting the pieces of a shattered dream, Mr. Brown suggested,
Listen, Mrs. Matabane, I'll buy your child a few primers if you agree to give me these books."
"What use will they be to you?" my mother asked.
"You just said you can't read them."
They'll look beautiful on my shelves," Mr. Brown smiled. My mother gave him the books, and a week later, I had two primers. Chapter 24. Despite the fact that, with my mother working, I could now afford a few books and a uniform, I continued wondering what I was being educated for. Over the years, since I began school, I had from time to time heard people around me say that whites had built black schools only to teach us how to be their slaves. Hearing this type of talk confused me even more about the objectives of all I was learning. Yes, I was coming out at the top of my class. Yes, I could read and write things in Tsonga. Yes, I could recite arithmetic tables. Yes, I knew how to draw the map of Alexandra. Yes, I could sing hymns and recite scriptures. But what did it all mean? And my father's constant preaching about how schools were, like Christianity, simply another white man's tool of keeping the black man down, didn't help much either. One of his strong points whenever he argued with my mother about the pros and cons of schooling was that blacks, before the coming of the white men to Africa, had always taught their offspring ways of being useful and productive in the villages while they were still in the cradle. And that by the time boys and girls were 5, 6, 7, and 8 years old, they were already making meaningful contributions to tribal society. On the other hand, he pointed out critically, the white man's education did not and could not do that. A man who knows nothing about books, my father said to me one day, but can feed himself and his family, is a million times better than a man who has read a million books but cannot feed himself and his family. Another day he said, what a man does is more important than what he knows. Still another day he said, I don't know why your mother is breaking her neck to pay for your schooling, for the white man will not look at you any better, even if you were the most educated black man in this world. There are people with degrees at my job, and I'm their boss, boy. How about that? I couldn't understand. But it came as no surprise when, hardly 3 years after I had begun school, the novelty of learning began to fade. Despite my continued successes at school, I failed to find real meaning in what I was being taught. More important, I failed to find, among the black people I lived with, and with whose accomplishes in life I was familiar, those particular individuals whom I could identify as having benefited from an education, and whose accomplishments in life could act as landmarks to orient me and help me set goals in life. Where were the lighthouses to guide my newly built ship of knowledge, just setting sail on a perilous journey upon a vast, turbulent, and unknown ocean of life? One afternoon after school, I was sitting on a tin chair near the window doing homework when I heard a medley of voices shouting out in the streets. Instantly, I abandoned my books and rushed outside to investigate. Coming down the street in a cloud of dust, 12 to 15 variously shaped black men in overalls, waving copies of newspapers over their heads, were chanting, Ali! 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 As they leaped into the air, stomped their feet, and embraced each other in ecstasy. What's going on? I asked of an older boy leaning with me against the fence and watching the group of men. People all over the yards leaned over fences, witnessing the spectacle. Haven't you heard? He bulged his eyes at me. Heard what? Where have you been since this morning? At school. Why? Didn't you hear people talk about it there? Talk about what? I asked, growing impatient at the suspense. Talk about the boxing fight, you fool, the boy said importantly. The big boxing fight that took place in America yesterday. America? What strange name is that? Who fought who? I asked eagerly. I understood what boxing meant, but I hadn't the faintest idea where America was. Ali, the boy said, jabbing his fist high in the air as a sign of victory. "Ali," he repeated reverently, "a black man. As black as all the people you see around here. The greatest fighter that ever lived in this world. He beat to death a white man." "Huh?" I gasped in disbelief. "A black man beat a white man to death? Where? In this country? No, fool. Not here. In America." "Where's that?" "Overseas." "Where's overseas?" "I don't know." The shouting man came abreast of where we were standing. The boy leaped over the railing and followed them as they went down the street, chanting and stomping their feet in fits of joy. I had to look after the house, so I didn't follow. The chanting of Ali's name, however, continued throughout the rest of the afternoon, well into the night. Throughout the week, on street corners, in stores, at shebeens all over the neighborhood, the talk was about the fight, and black people everywhere were enraptured by Ali's feats. Boys everywhere called themselves Ali and emulated his "float like a butterfly and sting like a bee" routines. I, too, rejoiced along with everybody, simply because a black man had finally beaten to death a white man. It turned out that the boy was exaggerating. By beat to death, he meant a knockout. Secretly, I dreamed of someday becoming as good a fighter as Ali and beating to death all the white men I could lay my hands on, beginning with the superintendent and all the white men on the police force. I considered the black policemen's crimes against their own people so heinous that once I became a fighter, beating them to death wouldn't be enough punishment. I would squash them like vermin under the wheels of a bulldozer I would have bought with my boxing revenues. That dream of becoming a boxer, however, was shattered when one evening I accompanied a group of neighborhood boys to the local boxing club. A stuffy, dimly lit, bare-walled cubicle with a cement floor so damp and slippery that it seemed a miracle how the throng of furiously sweating, shirtless men and boys managed to work out without falling and breaking a limb. The place was used as a classroom during the day. "We want to learn how to box," the leader of our group said eagerly to the gym owner, an old man with a receding hairline. "Want to box, huh? How old are you?" We gave him our inflated ages. "Okay," he said. "Stand over there," motioning us to a semi-dark corner where a group of older boys was already assembled. The gym teemed with shirtless men and boys doing different things. Some skipped rope, some punched an old patchy bag hanging from the ceiling, and some did sit-ups and push-ups. "What are those men doing hitting at thin air?" I said to one of the boys, giggling. "The shadow boxing." "What's that?" "The hitting at their own shadows."
"What for?"
"They become good boxers that way." I began bombarding the boy with questions concerning pugilism. It seemed so different from the way we fought in the streets. It was cleaner. Soon, the gym owner came over, carrying two sets of worn, oversized gloves and bellowed. "Who among you wants to go first?" One of my friends pointed at me, laughing. I thought it was some kind of a joke, and I laughed too. The old man called me over. I went. He told me to take my shirt off. He turned his head toward a cluster of mean-looking boys in the far corner. "Who among you wants to fight this boy?" he asked. I gasped. "Who? Me?" I looked about. "Yes, he meant me."
"I don't know how to box, sir," I whimpered.
I've never boxed before.
Don't be a sissy now, the old man said. There's nothing to it.
Haven't you used your fists before? Or are you afraid of him because he looks big?
A boy with thick thighs and muscled arms and a shaved head full of sores had volunteered to fight me. My pride was on the line. I told the gym owner that I wasn't afraid of anybody.
That's the spirit, boy, the old man said, patting me on the shoulder.
Ali was much smaller than the white man, yet he knocked him out cold. Hearing this gave me some courage.
You boys fight every day in the streets, the old man went on, as he'd loved me. Here, you'll learn the art of boxing.
My opponent's eyes were big, red and shining, as if he were high on benzene. He looked so mean and deadly that, as his large, scaly, muscled hands were being gloved, I had second thoughts about wanting to mess with him. A circle formed around us. The old man announced that he would referee the fight, which was slated for 3 rounds. A wave of excitement surged through the tight crowd, and people started making predictions and bets. I was assigned a corner consisting of 2 boys in their teens.
You'll be Ali, the old man said to me, as he brought my opponent and me together in the middle of the ring.
Turning to the hairless boy, he said, and you'll be Schmeling.
But I want to be Ali, the hairless boy complained.
You'll do as I tell you, the old man retorted. Turning to the crowd of spectators, he said, lifting my hand high up,
this here is Muhammad Ali, alias Cassius Clay.
Lifting the hairless boy's,
and this is Max Schmeling.
Yay! 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 Come on, Ali!
Someone said.
Ali! 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 Ali!
The crowd erupted into a chant.
Come on, Schmeling!
Said a lone voice.
I bubbled with fear and excitement.
The gloves I had on were so heavy I could hardly lift up my arms.
Shake hands, the old man said. Instinctively, I swung at the hairless boy, catching him on the jaw with a wicked, unexpected left. He staggered, grimacing, but didn't fall. He came back with fire in his eyes. He was about to fling himself at me when the old man interposed himself between the two of us and said to me angrily,
"You don't hit when I say shake hands." I was about to tell him that I didn't know any of the rules when he cried,
box on!
Before I knew what was happening, a vicious right landed on my nose. It sent me crashing into the human wall. The wall pushed me back. Fuming, I went at my opponent like a maddened bull seeing red, punching the best I could given the immense weight of the gloves. I kept on swinging and missing and spinning.
Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!
The cry went out. I didn't know whether they were telling me to kill the hairless boy, which I didn't want to do, or him to kill me. While pondering the matter, a lightning uppercut to my jaw spun me 180 degrees. I spit blood. I had bit my lips and tongue. While still dizzy from the blow, another came. Then another, to the nose, to the stomach, to the head, to my crotch. I had become a punching bag.
Stop! Stop! Stop, please!
I bawled, trying in vain to parry the blows, staggering about in a fog.
I can't see!
Pretend you didn't hear him say that, I heard the old man tell my opponent. I tried to cover my face with the heavy gloves, but I couldn't. The blows kept coming. I felt my knees wobble.
Fight back, boy, fight! Don't be a wimp, fight!
I can't, I whimpered. I can't see. The blows kept coming. Suddenly everything became blurred, then dark.
My feet gave way under me. I slumped to the floor, knocked out. Reviving, I found myself in a corner. The old man was busy dabbing my forehead with a wet, dirty sponge. My friends who had led me to the slaughter came over and offered words of consolation. I shrugged them aside. I hated them. The old man said, "Not a bad fight, boy. Not a bad fight at all. You learn. Are you all right?" he asked, as he saw me rubbing my puffed eyes. "Yes," I nodded, though my head felt like a lump of lead. "I'm fine." I told him I wanted to go home. "Will you come back tomorrow?" he asked hopefully. "You didn't box that badly, you know. The mistakes you made can be easily corrected. Anyway, the other boy is one of my seasoned fighters. With a couple more fights, who knows, you could be on your way to becoming another Ali. You've got potential." To hell with Ali, I told myself as I left the gym. From that day, I hated boxing. Chapter 25. On a cold grey morning in 1968, I woke up and found the world deep in mourning. Throughout the long and confused day, wherever I went, I met black people with grief and rage in their eyes. At school, I heard teachers whisper to one another in uneasy, subdued tones. "The white bastards finally killed him." "Yes, they assassinate them over there, and they jail them and throw away the key over here. The white bastards are the same the world over. They differ only in their tactics to keep the black man down. His death will be avenged. Just you wait and see." Wondering who it was that had been killed, and why his death had aroused so much anger and grief, I began asking questions of some of the older boys at school. "It's a black man that's been murdered." "He lived in America." "I don't know his name." As I went about the township throughout that long, grief-stricken afternoon, rumors began filtering into my always inquisitive ears that the black man being mourned was a preacher and a leader of august stature in America, and that he had been assassinated by a white man. I wondered why there was so much fuss over his death, considering that he was a black man. I had heard many stories in my history classes about black men who had been butchered, gunned, hanged in cold blood by whites. But none of those deaths, to the best of my knowledge, had ever had such widespread reverberations and enraged so many black people. What seemed more absurd was that this dead black preacher and leader was not even from Alexandria. Throughout the township, in every street I went, I saw grown-ups assembled in clusters to read the papers and to whisper about its dark and dastardly contents. Because a newspaper was never bought at home, I went to the newsstand on 12th Avenue in the hope of catching a glimpse of the newspaper photo of the man, if there was any, who was causing so much furor. However, so many people were crowding the newspaper boy that day that I couldn't get near enough to have a look at the papers. As I stood debating what to do, my eyes wandered about and fell upon several placards in red ink impaled upon a nearby fence. The placards read, "Extra, extra, King is dead." I ran back home, pondering who this king was. At home, I found my mother breastfeeding the new baby, Dinah. "Who's that man that got killed, Mama?" "I don't know who he is," my mother said in a tone expressing a reluctance to talk about the subject. "I've never heard of him until today." "His name is King. Was he some kind of a chief?" I don't know. He didn't live in this country. He lived in America, Mama, I said naturally, as if I knew where America was. Somehow the name America had stuck in my mind since the day Ali won the boxing match. Who told you that? My mother asked. I heard, I said. Yes, they say he lived in America, but I don't know where that is. All I know is this country. This king you are asking about. I hear many people, those that went to school and can read newspapers, say that he was a God-fearing man who died fighting to set his people free, to get them equal rights. What are equal rights, Mama? She thought pensively for a moment or two, then said, equal rights are laws which give black people the same opportunities as white people. Do black people in this country have equal rights? No. Why not? Because white people have taken away all our rights. White people again! Why were they seemingly behind every major issue I wanted to know about? Why were they always the architects of every woe the black man had? Why were they always taking things away from black people? Were they never satisfied with what they've got? Why weren't black people fighting them? Was it because white people had, as I'd seen in movies, guns, swords, bombs, and tanks? Has anybody fought to get them back? I thought that if black people were somehow able to get hold of bombs, tanks, guns, swords, and machetes, then white people would be in for it. And oh, how I yearned for the day when armies of black peasants would invade the white world and butcher, guillotine, hang, machine gun, bury alive and drown in hot lead every bad white man alive. Again, my mother paused for a moment to reflect. You're very curious, child, she said. I doubt if the story will mean anything to you. I want to know, Mama, I said. Once I remember, she began, black people did attempt to fight for their rights. It was the year in which you were born. A group of learned black people organized a march of protest to show white people that they didn't want to carry passes no more. Did they get those rights? No. How come? Many of those people who marched were shot and killed by the police. How many? 69. That many? I gasped. Where was this? It was in Sharpeville, near a police station. Why didn't the black people fight back? Didn't they carry guns too? Didn't they shoot back? I said blindly. No, my mother said. Black people can't carry guns. It's against the law. Has anyone since fought for any rights? No. Why? Because everyone is afraid. Afraid of what? Afraid of dying, silly. Now stop asking questions and go do your homework. When I grow up, Mama, I said stoutly, as I took my books to go do homework with a friend who lived in the neighborhood. I'll fight for my rights. My mother stared at me, but said nothing. Chapter 26. One day, following a series of months during which I had been repeatedly punished by teachers for being without certain reading books, I decided to quit school permanently. Now, there was a rule in my school which gave teachers authority to expel a pupil who was absent from school for over a month without a solid reason. Aware of the existence of such a rule, I stayed away from school for something like 3 weeks. I would leave home saying I was going to school when in truth I was headed for the junkyard on 14th Avenue, where I rendezvoused with a group of boys from other tribal schools who also played hooky. The average age of the group was 8. We would spend the day scouring the ghetto for warehouses where Shebeen queens stored their illicit hooch. We would best in using crowbars and steal beer and whiskey bottles, which we sold and used the proceeds to go to King's Bioscope. We would attend the afternoon show, usually featuring films about the Wild West and gladiators. Upon leaving King's, we would go to the open veldt, where we would imitate the various fighting methods, using sharpened sticks and iron rods we had seen in the pictures. We thought we were imitating the reality of white people. At sunset, I would leave for home. "Why are you home so late?" my mother would ask. I would lie to her that I was late because I had to stay behind for choir rehearsals. Because my mother couldn't read, there seemed no way for her to find out the truth. What I didn't know, however, was that each time I came back and lied that I had been to school, she would wait for me to leave the house, then take my exercise books to a next-door neighbor to find out whether the material appearing on the last pages of each book was indeed the latest work. Finding out that it wasn't, that in fact the last entries were dated, she kept count of the number of days I was absenting myself from school. She meticulously kept the records for 3 weeks, and in the fourth, she went to my school and had a talk with the principal. She did all this without arousing even the slightest of my suspicions. One Monday morning, toward the end of what would have been my fourth week away from school, she followed me secretly to find out where I was actually going. She gave the information of the whereabouts of the junkyard to the principal. 2 days later, on a Wednesday, I left home on the pretense that I was headed for school. Instead, I headed for the junkyard. I found the gang lounging lazily atop the hood of a scrapped 65 Chevy, basking in the flaring morning sun, waiting for me. "We must get to the Bioscope early today," announced the gang leader, a 12-year-old boy named Mnyamani, the black one. "There's a great double feature," he added, and continued to pass around small bottles of glue and benzene for the others to smoke. I didn't smoke because each time I tried to, I ended up feeling nauseated and dizzy and would vomit. "By the way, what's playing?" I asked. "Spartacus and For a Few Dollars More." "I thought that was next week," I said as I stashed my books underneath the dashboard. "I thought Street with No Name and Symmetry Without Crosses were playing. They moved those to next week because of the Easter holidays." While we waited for Mnyamani to map out our bottle-stealing itinerary for the day, out of the corner of one eye, I saw a group of schoolboys coming down the street, heading in our direction. I paid no particular attention to them until they had surrounded the junkyard. "Johannes!" a voice boomed from somewhere behind me, taking me unawares. "We've come to take you back to school." I whirled in the direction of the voice, and instantly I froze with fear as I came face to face with the towering figure of Mandlebe, Big Ears, Bovet's notorious truant hunter, barely 3 yards away from me. "You're not taking me back," I yelled, leaping up on the hood and preparing to defend myself. "Don't be foolish," said Mandlebe, advancing toward me. "There are too many of us. Besides, if you come peacefully, nobody will get hurt." We have done nothing. My friends whimpered as they deserted me. I'm not going back, I said, starting to panic.
Then we'll have to take you back by force, Mandlebe said.
The group closed in. Realizing that they were about to rush me, I reached under the hood of the dashboard and grabbed a crowbar that the gang used in opening bottle stockades.
Don't come any closer or I'll kill you, I yelled, brandishing the crowbar.
We are too many for you, Mandlebe pointed out.
Give yourself up peacefully, and I'll tell the principal and the teachers that you didn't give us any trouble, and they'll take it easy on you.
No, I shook my head. I knew he was lying. Once they had me back at school, it was the end. No teacher would ever entertain the thought of mitigating in any way the punishment of a truant. I had seen other truants being lashed mercilessly.
Go back to school, I said. Go back, and I promise to be at school tomorrow, on my own accord.
I was lying. I was thinking of running away from home forever and living in a junkyard somewhere.
Come on, said Mandlebe. What's the difference? Come with us now and get it over with.
I don't have any books with me, I lied.
You don't need any books today, said Mandlebe. There's no regular school but choir rehearsals in preparation for the competition next week.
I'm in no choir, I said, so I won't be needed.
Mandlebe apparently decided that he had bargained with me enough, for he suddenly lunged at me. Instinctively, I let go of the crowbar. He ducked, and the heavy bar crashed harmlessly into the hood of the Chevy. The swing was so powerful that it dented the metal. Mandlebe grabbed my legs, and I came crashing down to the ground. Bleeding from the mouth and nose, I tried to fight, yelling, "Turn me loose! Turn me loose!" But the boys were simply too many and too powerful. Within minutes, they had me bound, hands and feet, with a thick rope. At school, I found the principal and all the male teachers waiting for me, their faces cold and menacing, as they tested their canes between their hands. My mother was also inside the principal's office.
"Whip him good," she impassively gave the order, which was not necessary. And there and then I knew it was the end. She left the office and stood outside. The teachers descended upon me like starved vultures out of the sky. They commenced the savage beating, taking turns whenever one teacher's hand got tired. I fainted. They revived me only to whip me some more. I spent an entire week bedridden, unable to sit up or sleep. For the rest of my primary school years, I seldom, if ever, cut school for any reason. Even when I was gravely ill, I would crawl to school, and the teachers would send me back home.
Chapter 27. My 10th birthday came and went, like all the other 9, uncelebrated. Having never had a normal childhood, I didn't miss birthdays. To me, they were simply like other days, to be survived. Strangely, however, on each birthday I somehow got the feeling that I had aged more than 1 year. Suffering seemed to age me more than birthdays. Though I was only 10, Black life seemed to have, all along, been teaching me the same lessons of survival and making the same demands upon me for that survival as it was doing to grown-ups. Thus, emotionally, I had aged far beyond my 10 years. Alexandra continued being the decaying shanty town it was before I was born. The police continued with their raids. children continued dying of malnutrition. The gutters continued to overflow with filth, and hovels continued mushrooming all over the place. Families continued being deported to the tribal reserves. I continued going to school and to the movies and playing soccer. Waves of immigrant workers continued arriving in Alexandra. This time, however, they were being housed in newly built hostels, constructed where houses had been demolished, instead of compounds. And there was talk that eventually the whole of Alexandra would be nothing but hostels. Our neighbors continued accusing one another of witchcraft. My father continued drinking and gambling and quarreling with my mother, often beating her up. In short, the suffering of black people continued on the increase. And I continued getting the feeling that we, blacks of Alexandra, were like animals, quarantined inside a cage by the white men, fomenting ignorance and death. And that there was nothing we could do about it but await each our violent end. One late Friday evening, when I was nearing the end of my 10th year, an event occurred that precipitated the greatest crisis of my childhood. I was an eyewitness to a murder. Upon that night, as on every Friday night, the dark and dusty streets of Alexandra swarmed with black workers returning home from work and about to begin celebrating the start of a weekend, a time when many of them would be drowning their pain, sorrow, and suffering with all-night orgies and feasting in shebeens throughout the township. I was returning home after a long afternoon of playing soccer at the stadium on 12th Avenue. As it was payday, all along the streets I met black people hurrying, hurrying, hurrying. The pittances of an 8 days week in sweatshops jingling in their deep pockets. Some hurried home, there to feed the many hungry mouths awaiting their arrival. Others headed for the crazy comfort of shebeens, where, in one fleeting moment of glory, they could be the masters of their destinies. As I turned the corner into 13th Avenue, I saw, coming down the street, a group of about 6 totsies chasing 2 men. Remembering my mother's warning about what to do when encountering totsies, "When you see Tsotsi's child, run for the nearest cover until they are gone," I fled into a nearby yard. I dove into the patch of tall dried grass in front of the gate. I lay flat in the tall grass and watched the scene in the street. The Tsotsis were rapidly gaining on the 2 men, who were being slowed by the heavy paper bags they were unwilling to let go. The chase reached alongside the spot where I was hiding. I held my breath and kept still. Suddenly, one of the men being chased swung into the yard where I was hiding, apparently thinking that he might get help from the inhabitants of several of the shacks in it. He was mistaken, for no sooner had he entered the yard than shutters were closed and doors barricaded. The Tsotsis followed him in, letting the other men go.
"Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me," the men begged as the Tsotsis caught up with him. "Take everything I have, but please don't kill me."
"Shut up," came the acrimonious reply as the Tsotsis, like a pack of scavengers, surrounded him. The moon was full, and it seemed daylight. I craned my neck to see what was going on. What I saw made me gasp with horror. Having drawn gleaming sharp knives, meat cleavers and tomahawks, the Tsotsis began carving the man as he howled for mercy.
"Don't kill me. Please don't kill me. I have 10 children. Please don't kill me," Take everything I have, but please don't kill me.
The Tsotsis paid no heed to his pleas. In fact, they grinned at his cries. Through some superhuman effort, it seemed, the man, now bleeding heavily from gaping wounds, managed to break through the cordon of butchers and make a mad dash for the street. The Tsotsis didn't chase after him immediately, tearing a while to rummage through the packages he had dropped. The wounded man staggered left and right.